From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida legislature puts a halt, at least for now, on Governor DeSantis's using a disaster emergency fund for immigration enforcement.
And anytime you want to extend a state of emergency for things like immigration, we need to approve the dollars for it from that fund.
Also this week, with so many folks now eager to fight for their rights, a legal expert opines there are times and places where that response may not be the best course of action.
It is not worth it to get into a confrontational situation with law enforcement. It's just simply not worth it.
We'll also get an update on how the budget crafting process is going at the Florida Capitol. And spoiler alert, it's not all that great. And we'll find out how the push for state regulation of data centers is going. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and our weekly wrap-up of top stories from the 2026 Florida lawmaking session in Tallahassee.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.
How Governor Ron DeSantis' administration has been spending money from the state's emergency fund on immigration enforcement has been a topic of debate in Tallahassee at this year's legislative session's halfway point. WFSU's Tristan Wood spoke with the Florida Phoenix's Liv Caputo about that and other immigration bills advancing in the legislature.
We are a little past the halfway point in the legislative session, and like the past several years, immigration has been one of the hot button issues. I have with me the Florida Phoenix's immigration reporter, Liv Caputo. Hey, Liv, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. So one of the things that I've been following a little bit, and I know you've been really breaking a lot of stories on, is this kind of emergency fund controversy with the governor. Can you walk me through what's happening with that?
Yeah, so basically the state has had since 2022 this emergency fund, which basically lets the governor quickly draw funds to pay for emergency cleanup, disaster cleanup without legislative approval. So we've had this fund since 2022. In 2023, the governor declared a state of emergency for immigration. So since then, the Florida Division of Emergency Management, which is the agency in charge of emergencies, basically, has been responding to illegal immigration through this fund. A few weeks ago, we found out that FDEM had spent $573 million on immigration out of this fund. And then recently it came out that $406 million of that has been spent in just the last 6 months. Some of those charges included private jet flights to and from Alligator Alcatraz. They included restaurant meals, boats, motor vehicles, a lot of different things like that. Controversy over those charges. And so now there has been an effort by the House to put some guardrails on that emergency fund.
Why do you think it's coming from the House?
There's a few reasons, probably. I mean, the House has been really at odds with both the governor and the Senate, especially this session. So there's probably an element of just, there's some opposition. There's opposition, you know, you want this, so I don't want this. There's some of that. But then there's also, I mean, I would say that's probably the main driving force is the House and is not getting along with the Senate or with the governor. The Senate wanted to keep the emergency fund as is. The House initially said, you know what, Governor DeSantis, we don't want you even using the fund for immigration enforcement. And there was a lot of backlash from the right on that. The House has walked back that proposal now and now says, okay, you can use it for immigration, but you can't use it for aircraft, for boats, for motor vehicles. And anytime you want to extend a state of emergency for things like immigration, we need to approve the dollars for it from that fund. So that's kind of where we're at right now in terms of the emergency.
So let me make sure I understand, Astandia. Essentially, the House wants to place guardrails on how the governor spends money related to the immigration from this emergency fund. The Senate hasn't voiced whether they're willing to go with those limits, have they?
No, they haven't. Senate President Ben Albritton was asked about it today. He said that they're open to discussions. We don't really know what those discussions would look like. You know, bottom line here, we don't know if we're going to have an emergency fund by the end of this session. We don't know if we do have an emergency fund. Is it going to have more guardrails? Is it not? We don't know. Right now, there is no emergency fund. That's kind of the baseline. And this comes after all of these issues that these perceived issues with immigration spending. All of it has come to light in just maybe the past 2 weeks of what has been spent, how much has been spent, and what it's been spent on.
Stepping aside from, you know, emergency fund and kind of that spending, what immigration bills have you been following that have been moving in the legislature?
I will say there's not as many immigration bills per se this session as there were like last session. The main one that passed the House was the E-Verify bill, which basically said if you are an employer, doesn't matter if you have a private business or a public business, doesn't matter if you have one employee or 200, you need to be using the E-Verify system. And E-Verify is basically a federal database that checks whether somebody can legally work in the country. So that bill passed the House. Back to what we said earlier, the House and Senate are not getting along. The Senate has not looked at an E-Verify bill yet. That's one bill. The other one is a pretty big immigration package, which deals with everything from banning non-English driver's license tests to criminalizing employers who purposely hire over 50 undocumented workers. They could face a third-degree felony. So that's the other big immigration bill. Other than that, other than those two, plus the emergency fund bill moving in the House, we're not really seeing much else immigration legislation.
Finally, you know, I know session can be, you know, quite 60 days of long hours for us journalists at the Capitol. What's your secret for getting through it, you know?
Oh, my secret for getting through the session, the 60 days, probably just knowing that every day is going to be something new. Every day there's drama, there's tension, there's new bills, there's all of that. I would say my secret to getting through it is just anticipating that I will never be bored. I think that's the best way to put it.
Thank you for updating us about immigration bills and what's going on with the emergency fund.
Mm-hmm, of course. Yeah, anytime. Appreciate it.
That was Liv Caputo with the Florida Phoenix. She was interviewed by WFSU's Tristan Wood. Several former detainees at Alligator Alcatraz, the facility in the Everglades, recently testified about their inability to obtain legal counsel and the punishment they received when they asked for representation. To learn more about the issues migrants are dealing with in the legal system, WGCU's Jennifer Crawford spoke with Fort Myers immigration attorney Indira DeMine.
Can you first explain what is your practice? What does it focus on? What are the cases it's mostly facing right now regarding immigration?
We are a full-service immigration law firm. We handle everything from investor visa employment petitions to removal defense. So we represent folks who are currently in immigration court proceedings, and we have seen an influx of those cases as of late.
Can you explain what concerns you have, if any, about the handling of immigration cases currently?
We've seen an influx of detention, obviously. And in the past, I'm able to meet with family members and say, this is what to expect next. After your family member's taken into custody, this is what happens next. That has sort of been all over the place as of late. And I think because part of that might be because the system is a little overwhelmed. Folks might be detained, but it's harder to find them in the system. So we look them up on the ICE detainee locator. We cannot find them. It is taking much longer to file a bond motion to get folks out of detention center. We're finding that folks are moving from one detention center to another, and that's causing significant delays in their cases. There is higher deniability on bonds. So immigrants are spending a longer time in detention center. What I would consider some due process issues here in the United States, if you have been charged and arrested for a crime, within 24 hours, you get a first appearance, no matter the seriousness of that crime. So you could be arrested for homicide, and within 24 hours, you get to see a judge. The judge decides whether or not you should be released on a bond. It's not the same for immigrants. It can be months upon months before an immigrant sees an immigration judge and requests a bond.
How should an individual react when they are approached by an immigration officer? Because there are multiple things that you need to be concerned about and careful of.
I like to weigh what are the consequences and the benefits of my actions. And so if you were to say, I am not going to respond to your question, and if you were to resist that officer, ultimately, what is the benefit that you as an undocumented immigrant will gain from that? To me, it is not worth it to get into a confrontational situation with law enforcement. It's just simply not worth it. It is not going to benefit your immigration case in the long run by getting into one of these confrontational situations with law enforcement. In a criminal case, there might be some benefits to saying, I don't wish to speak to you. I'm exercising my right to remain silent, because in your criminal case, that might work to your advantage. But for an undocumented immigrant, if you are undocumented or a visa overstay, at the end of the day, if you have no lawful status, whether you spoke to the ICE officer and disclosed that to the ICE officer will not change that underlying fact. My advice usually to my clients is to cooperate, not get into a confrontational situation. It's not going to help you in the long run.
In situations like we're seeing in Minnesota, people are claiming that the presence of ICE and Border Patrol is violating state rights. Where is that line when it comes to a state's responsibility and federal authorities?
Traditionally, obviously, immigration has been in the purview of the federal government. And only within the last few years, we have seen where the state of Florida has made specific immigration-related changes. SB State Bill 1718 that mandates employers to e-verify if they hire 25 or more employees in the state of Florida. While that's a state law, it has immigration implications. I have seen where state laws are being implemented that impact immigration overall. That's a dicey issue. Where does state law end and where does the federal authority come in? That ultimately will become a question for the Supreme Court, because what we're seeing is whether overlap or contradiction between state and federal law. And because state law enforcement are cooperating with ICE, we don't necessarily have the same friction that we're seeing in Minnesota. But ultimately, I think it's going to come down to the Supreme Court sort of looking into that issue, because we are seeing it come up in Minnesota.
That was Fort Myers immigration attorney Indira DeMine speaking with WGCU's Jennifer Crawford. Coming up on Capitol Report, with a few weeks left in the session, the two chambers are far apart when it comes to spending and communicating.
You know, it's hard to say for sure what was going on behind the scenes, but I think it's really emblematic of the divide between the House and the Senate.
And even though Florida is not yet awash in data centers, it seems that might be changing. A couple of happenings this week in the Florida House with spending. The full House quickly passed its $113.6 billion budget proposal. But House Speaker Daniel Perez warned negotiations with the Senate could be rocky, possibly leading to an extension of the legislative session. The regular session is scheduled to end March 13th. Chamber disagreements last year led to an extra 45 days of session. The House also voted to renew the governor's emergency fund. It includes some spending guardrails, unlike the Senate version. In addition to natural disasters, it does allow spending on man-made or technological disasters. And for a deeper discussion about spending bills in the legislature, Gina Jordan sat down with our own Tristan Wood and WUSF reporter Douglas Soule. This was part of WFSU's podcast, Speaking Of.
So what are the odds, you guys, that this legislative session is going to drag on like last year?
A very good question, because I have Vegas plans.
Yeah, I have a vacation planned for the week after session's supposed to end, so I hope.
So we have to convince these guys to be done by March 13th, and all they really have to do is the budget, but we know how that goes.
Yeah, there's only one thing they have to do per the Constitution, and that is get the budget done. Last year, they extended session a month and a half to do that.
I think reading the tea leaves and stuff, but I could expect it to go longer again this year. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, luckily for us, though, they usually do take like a week break after the scheduled time, you know, because we're not the only ones that book vacations. But that doesn't mean that it won't extend like a lot past its scheduled time again this year.
Obviously, the hope for everyone is that that does not occur, because we also have special sessions coming.
Right. Okay. Well, we have to unpack all of this. First of all, I want to talk about when they rolled out the budget. That was weird, because the Senate said, we're going to be respectful and wait for the House, because the House is hosting the budget this year. Then the House suddenly rolled out the budget. What was happening there?
You know, it's hard to say for sure what was going on behind the scenes, but I think it's really emblematic of the divide between the House and the Senate. It's not a good indicator of efficient communication between the chambers. It's not a good indicator of the session getting done by mid-March. Of course, it could. We do not know. But it was certainly a little confounding, and it's going to be interesting to see how the dynamic between the chambers unrolls from here.
Especially now, like when you see what they actually did roll out. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot of tense negotiations. And if, you know, at this early onset, they're already not on the same page about when they're going to roll it out, and their communication on doing that, it's not working. I mean, it could be definitely a sign of further tense negotiations to come.
Yeah. A couple of big things with the budget. First of all, we've been talking about this Florida DOGE, the Department of Governmental Efficiency. Those activities are under the control of the CFO right now?
Well, from my understanding, the CFO is doing it. But one of the things that I was watching when I saw, you know, these budget rollouts is that the House wants to kind of like reconstitute and give power back to like a Florida Auditor General, which would be under the control of the House and the Senate. And when I was reading through that job responsibilities, it's like auditing and having access to local governments, being accountable to the House Speaker and Senate President, not being an elected position. Because kind of what you've seen happen with this Florida DOGE thing is that CFO Blazingolia, who is appointed by Governor Ron DeSantis, he was never elected to Florida CFO, and now he's running to be elected for the first time. So as he's been going around the state doing these audits, you know, the events have seemed to kind of double as kind of like a campaign appearance. He's calling out Democrat-controlled, you know, cities and counties, pointing a finger at them for audits, banging the drums about culture war issues. However, it seems like the House wants to rein in a lot of that responsibility and auditing under the realm of the legislative branch. It would make sense that the audit of it would fall under the purview of the legislature to be able to make sure that, you know, the money it's allocating is being spent correctly.
Also, a biggie that both of you have covered is this emergency fund, which has now expired, because the House and the Senate have disagreements over how that money should be spent. That is specifically money for the governor to use for emergencies. And that's what it's supposed to be, is for emergencies. Now, it's been funded since 2022 with close to $5 billion so far. And Senate Minority Leader Lori Berman is asking for more legislative oversight.
Over $500 million has been spent on immigration, with no time frame on reimbursement from the federal government. $405 million was spent in the last 6 months, including $500,000 spent on private jets and thousands spent at restaurants. This fund is only controversial because of the way it has been used to enable a political state of emergency that has gone on for over 3 years.
And then you have a Democrat, Boca Raton Senator Tina Pawlowski, who voted in favor of this previously, and now she is saying that this fund needs to expire.
I'm so disappointed in this chamber. We have the opportunity to fix something that isn't working as well as it should have. In 2022, we voted for this fund for natural disasters because we knew that it was too hard to get the money. I remember we had to come back in a special session and get money for Hurricane Michael. And that's cumbersome. And we're not here all the time. So I understood, and I took the leap of faith and voted for it. But we've had 4 years to see what this has become, and we've had 4 years to see the abuse.
So Senate President Ben Albritton is saying, look, this fund is necessary. He has pushed off potential changes for a different batch of lawmakers in the future.
I also would believe that, you know, the legislature of 2027-28, there's still ample time for them to have plenty of conversation about how this process is working and, you know, what questions they may have. You know, the goal is to get the trust fund reinstated so that we don't find ourselves in some kind of forced jeopardy in the future with, you know, what may happen this summer.
So he wants to kick the can down the road. He's like, let's just let it be and somebody else can deal with it. Interesting, though, that the House and the Senate are just not in the same place right now with that and might not be. All right, let's wrap up by talking about the special sessions that are already in the works. Do we have one officially called or two officially called?
Just one officially called, and that's the one on redistricting in April. The governor has floated a special session on the property tax reduction idea as well. Initially, when DeSantis had said that, some in the House were like, no, we want to do it during the session itself. And the House has certainly been pushing forward various measures that would in various ways address the property tax. But the Senate hasn't pushed any bill. But we still have a month left, so a lot can change. And maybe they do make a move on it. But right now, Senate President Albritton is being very every time he's done a press availability, he's asked about this. And he says, we're still working through it in the Senate. We're still working through it in the Senate. We're measuring. And that's been the case up to this point. Will it continue into the spring, and will it continue in a way that needs a special session? We shall see.
I would say almost certainly yes, if I was reading the tea leaves. But, you know, there are several different proposals that the House has put out. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what DeSantis actually wants and what it actually looks like. He's been very vocal about it, and he's floated ideas about using state funds to make up money in rural areas while they're trying to cut the budget this year because of decreased revenues. So it'd be interesting to see if a special session comes and DeSantis pushes forward a plan, what it actually looks like, because there hasn't been a lot of details from him about what the actual mechanics will be.
Yeah, he's been very vocal about wanting a reduction, but not vivid in the plan. We haven't seen a specific proposal from right. him, nor have we seen one from the Senate. But DeSantis also emphasizes that he would like, and the other legislative leaders have also said this, that they want only one proposal to make the ballot this November. So we're really far from the conclusion point of this property tax debate, but it's one that's enormously important. We're talking about, I mean, one, just from the perspective of you could have a reduction in tax. Everyone cares about that. But also importantly, local governments are incredibly concerned because a lot of their local services are funded by that property tax. So if this does pass, and depending on what fashion it and form it takes, you could see a reduction in services that residents also care a lot about.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, guys. WSF's Douglas Soule, part of your Florida team. WFSU's Tristan Wood. We have another month or so. Thank you guys for your reporting.
We do. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida doesn't have a massive data center operating yet, but proposals to build them are popping up across the state, including one that would cover 1,300 acres in Polk County. These centers use immense amounts of energy for things like artificial intelligence or cryptocurrency. They require millions of gallons of water every day to cool the systems. There's also a concern about pollution from forever chemicals. WUSF's Jessica Mazaros talked about this new trend in tech with Earth Justice Senior Attorney Christina Weichert.
A traditional data center was a place where servers, your external servers, lived. So that could be a floor in an office building. The bigger ones may be a single building in a warehouse. Very, very discrete locations. And we actually have a number of those in the state of Florida already. On the other side, we have the new hyperscale data centers, and these are, you know, spanning millions of square feet. being housed in usually multiple buildings. And these data centers require a significant amount of energy to operate in a way that the traditional data centers do not. And they also come with a number of environmental concerns and community impacts that you will not see from the traditional data centers.
Can you talk a bit about the one that's proposed in Polk County? What's the status of that one?
So the data center in Polk County is in Fort Meade in particular. This is a hyperscale data center. It is proposed to be, I think, around 1.2, 1.3 gigawatts of electricity. So it's really on the high end of hyperscale data centers as well. And the proposal at the moment is still in the works. The developer came in and requested a zoning change for the area of land that they want to build this. And they got approved for this specialized type of zoning that allows for flexibility because the Fort Meade local government didn't have pre-existing regulations that would cover a hyperscale data center. I don't know that any of the Florida local governments have existing regulations that would cover these kinds of facilities. And what happens now is the developer will come to the city with a final site plan, and the city will reconsider whether to approve it, whether to create more conditions for the development moving forward, or whether to deny it.
Do you know how many others are in the works for Florida?
So there is one in Palm Beach County, one in Indiantown, one in Martin County, and one in Citrus County as well. I think that those are the ones that we're aware of at the time. But it seems like every week I'm getting notice of another one that is coming forward. So I wouldn't be surprised if even by the time this interview comes out, there's at least one more project that has popped up.
All of these proposals in Florida, how do they compare to what we're seeing all across the country?
Yeah, I think in general, across the country, we are seeing a huge push for new data centers coming in because of the growth of AI and the increased demand for that type of computing power. I think that there's a difference across the country in how they're being received. There are some places that are welcoming data centers in because there is this idea that they can bring economic support to local governments, which is actually not supported by the evidence of existing data centers. And they don't have the same information, like I said, about what the impacts are. And so there are those areas where data centers are coming in and, communities find out about it after the fact and are now straddled with the impacts of these data centers. And then there are also parts of the country that are, putting moratoriums in place to try to stop any data centers from coming in before they actually have the time to do that analysis and think through strategically, do we want these? Where should they go? How do we make sure that they are not going to be harming the people that live in our communities?
That was Christina Weichert of Earth Justice speaking with WUSF's Jessica Mazaros. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. And thanks also to Jennifer Crawford and Jessica Mazaros. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.